This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm your host, David Salkeld, a constitutional conservative, husband, and homeschool dad. Dr. Eric Walsh was one of the nation's leading health administrators until being fired in 2014 by the Georgia Department of Public Health. Family Research Council earlier in the week expressed outrage after the state of Georgia issued a legal demand that Dr. Eric Walsh, a lay pastor, hand over his sermons, sermon notes, and all pastoral documentation, including his Bible. Now, I don't know about you, but it sure seems to me like these types of cases are becoming more and more common. To provide us with the latest on his case, Dr. Walsh joined Tony on Wednesday.
Dr. Walsh, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, sir. Good to be here.
Now, I know today you held a press conference along with First Liberty. In fact, one of FRC's individuals was there, Travis Weber, who was our director of our Center for Religious Liberty, that set the stage for our listeners. I know I put a little bit of the information out there, but tell our listeners your story.
Well, I want to bring in my attorney, Jeremy Dice, with First Liberty Institute, and have him give a little bit of the background so he can bring in some of the legal aspects of this.
Hey, Tony, thanks for having us. Yeah, Dr. Walsh, as you laid out, was fired a couple of years ago, but you know now we're in the middle of this lawsuit, and the Attorney General's office, under the guidance of the Attorney General and Governor Deal, they've now demanded that Dr. Walsh provide his sermon notes and transcripts. And let me just explain for everybody to make sure this is clear. If he were not a party to this lawsuit, that would be a subpoena. And so this request has the full force of a subpoena, and there's no subject matter limitation on it. There's no time limitation on this request. So that means that any sermon he's ever given at any time since he started preaching at the age of 18, he's got to now create. And it means that if he scribbled a sermon outline on the back of a napkin, then he's got to turn over that napkin. If he's written in the margin of his Bible a note to remember to say something during a sermon, that Bible now has to be turned over to the Attorney General of the state of Georgia. This is a really remarkable intrusion upon the pulpit here in the state of Georgia.
That does. I mean, this is seems very excessive and obviously intrusive, breaching that wall of separation between the state and the church. Dr. Walsh, let me ask you this question. I mean, when they hired you in the state of Georgia, did they know that you had been a lay minister, that you had been preaching?
I don't know that. Actually, I think I did inform them of that, actually, at the time of the interview.
And subsequent to them hiring you, it's now been uncovered that they began looking at your sermons on a variety of topics, and then they quickly notified you that you had been terminated. Now, they have not said, they did not admit, and I'll point this question to Jeremy, they did not say that they fired him because he was preaching, but the paper trail appears to be pretty obvious.
Yeah, and now that they've asked for his sermons as a part of the discovery request, I'm kind of sitting here going, well, if it wasn't about his sermons that you fired him, why are you asking for his sermons? You see, what the government is doing here, it's akin to them kind of kicking down the door of his study and ransacking through his entire study, looking for evidence to somehow, in a sort of a desperate attempt to cover up their illegal behavior. It was illegal for them to ask for his sermons in the first place. It is illegal for an employer to consider an employee's religion in making employment decisions. And now that they've demanded these sermons, they've violated the Constitution on top of all of that. Look, it was nothing that Dr. Walsh did or didn't do at work. He was extremely well qualified, having served on President Obama's Advisory Council on HIV and AIDS and all the rest. They fired Dr. Walsh for something he said in a sermon, and that is absolutely wrong.
I mean, that's a religious test, essentially. And what this is, what I see this, and it's unfortunate that Georgia has become notorious for this under Governor Deal. I mean, you've got the fire chief there, Kelvin Cochran, in Atlanta, suffering a similar fate for writing a book for a men's Bible study. It's amazing that the South, where, you know, in the Bible Belt, you see this hostility toward toward religion. Where does this stand? What are the next steps for you?
Well, you know, it's interesting that Governor Deal has selected a new attorney general. The current attorney general is leaving as of next Monday. And the governor's hand-picked man is stepping into that role next Tuesday. It concerns me very much when you've had a governor like Governor Deal who has vetoed multiple pieces of legislation that would help men like Dr. Walsh and protect their religious liberty. Now his attorney general is put into that office here. You know, the last time Dr. Walsh turned over his sermons to the state of Georgia, he lost his job and his career. He's really concerned about having to respond to that now here in the state of Georgia. What are they going to do next? So we will be objecting to this request, and the state at that time has a choice to make. They can ask the court to compel Dr. Walsh to turn those sermons over, and if the court orders him and he refuses, he can be held in contempt of court for refusing that lawful order.
Well, we will be watching this very, very closely. Jeremy Dice, Dr. Walsh, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Tony.
You can find out more about Dr. Walsh and his case, as well as First Liberty, when you visit TonyPerkins.com. When we return, a look at the latest Obamacare controversy. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch right after this.
How important is a party platform? Some argue that since a platform is just a set of goals established by a political party, it can be easily ignored. As it turns out, platforms matter significantly. Why? In the past 30 years, Republicans in Congress voted for positions supported by their party platform 89% of the time, while Democrats did so at a rate of 74%. This matters. Because if Republicans and Democrats in Congress make good on their party platform's promises, people of faith heading to the polls in November can be confident that Republicans will defend life, marriage, and religious liberty, while Democrats will devalue those principles. It's now more important than ever to know exactly where both parties stand and to spread the word. For a concise two-page platform comparison on the issues that matter most to values voters, visit www.frcaction.org/2016.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. If you haven't gotten your notice lately, you've probably heard in the news that premiums for Obamacare coverage are expected to rise, on average, 22% next year for its benchmark plan. These are the kinds of increases that are going to literally force people to decide between healthcare and other basic necessities. Representative Ralph Abraham, a Republican from Louisiana and a family doctor at a rural clinic, has seen many times over just how broken Obamacare really is. Dr. Abraham joined Tony on Tuesday to talk about this issue.
Ralph, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thank you, Tony. Good to be here.
Are you surprised by the numbers, the percentage increases we're seeing in the premium cost under Obamacare?
Oh, not at all. And Trump is going to be right. The 25% number is not going to be right at all. I mean, you look at Arizona, they're looking at 115 to 116% increase. And what I can tell you is across the nation, it's going to be in the 40 to 60% range. I truly believe that. Because, as you've alluded to, it's the sicker people that are signing up. You can wait until you get sick to sign up. Then you can, once you get well, you can get out, and not paying your premiums. And then when you get sick again, you can simply go back in to the exchange and sign back up. So it's just ludicrous that the way the law was written. And what they're not telling you is that even with the Affordable Care Act being instituted, we still have over 30 million Americans that are uninsured. And so the numbers that are coming from the Obama administration, I am very, very skeptical of.
Well, I mean, first off, the whole thing defies the basic principles of economics, supply and demand, and you're right. The way it's written, you don't have to, you can get it right on your way to the hospital and
That's
you'll be
correct.
Covered. And so,
That's
I mean, right. the whole idea of the way this thing works is that, you know, people are in a pool, some people need it, some people don't, and therefore it offsets the cost that those who need it will have. But there's another side to this, and one of the reasons I want your perspective on this as one of a number of doctors that actually are serving now in Congress is the impact this is actually having on healthcare itself, the quality of our healthcare delivery system.
Well, it is having a tremendous effect on quality, because the quality that we are able to provide is not what it should be, unfortunately, because of this program under Obamacare. I can practice in one specialist that will take Obamacare. So if I have a patient that needs a gastroenterologist, a surgeon, you name the specialty, then I have to look beyond the borders of my area, and therefore that puts undue burden on the patient. The patient's probably not going to see the doctor if he or she could, as far as time constraints are. And again, this plays over and over a million times throughout the U.S. every day.
So, Congressman Abraham, what you're saying then is that you have a lot of doctors that are finding ways to establish practices outside the government system. They're not involved in it.
Yeah, much so. And it's not easy because, again, once you get on the government's roll, you know, getting off literally takes an act of Congress almost. And, again, they want you on there so they can dictate as to what you will and will not accept. The other issue that people really aren't attending to is how restrictive the prescription formulary is. I have actually had a patient, more than one, where I've had to look at four different drugs before I found one that the Obamacare formulary would pay for it. Now, that's not the drug that I initially wanted to give the patient because it's not on the list. Therefore, that patient probably is not going to get well as quick, probably going to end up in the ER, probably end up coming back to the doctor. And again, there you go with the circle that it just increases health costs exponentially because they just won't listen to what people like myself and certainly people smarter than me tell them how this thing should be run. But I think when it was being written, there were no medical doctors on the initial draft of the bill.
So what you have, Congressman Abraham, you're talking about you have bureaucrats essentially inserting themselves between a doctor and the patient in terms of what the doctor feels the best regimen is for that patient.
And you're exactly right. And, you know, the hidden costs here, and with these increased premiums, just come in uncovered, but there were over $1 trillion of tax increases in the Obamacare legislation. There were 21 new taxes added to Obamacare. And people can certainly Google that and look it up, and they're going to be amazed at what they're actually paying for and where they're paying it that they didn't even know about.
So we're paying a whole lot more for a whole lot less. That's typical
That's right.
government.
And with these, increased premiums, the government is trying to say, the bureaucrats are saying, well, it's not going to affect the patients because they're going to increase the subsidies. Well, guess who gets that deal? The good old American taxpayer again. It's like everybody listening, you and I, we're on the hook for this money, and it's got to stop. We get to the point in this country where we are out of control with our debt and with our spending, and this is just going to just throw gasoline on the fire.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. Hope you had a great weekend. I did. But it's back to work. We're now talking about Obamacare. It's time for the fall enrollment. Projections on increases, once again, very high, depending on what state you're in. Congressman Abraham, all right, let me ask you this question. That is, what is the prescription to stop the runaway cost that we're seeing under Obamacare, and how can we restore our health care delivery system to a way that it actually works for the average American?
The Obamacare model is not salvageable in any way. You could not throw enough life preservers to keep it from drowning in its own abyss. So it's got to be thrown out, and there is a plan. There are actually two, maybe three good plans in Congress that would work today. You would have to certainly phase out the Obamacare model over a period of maybe 2 to 3 months, just to have the program in. But we get to the point in Congress where we have been looking at this for literally almost 2 years now, very seriously. I'm on the Doctors Caucus, and this is one of the main things that we discuss every time we meet, is how to get out of the Affordable Care Act and put something in place that actually works. So when President Obama and his administration says that now Americans don't have a plan, they have a plan. It's a very good plan. It works. It puts the doctors and the patient back in charge of their health care, so they can talk one-on-one to decide what's best for him or her, and get the government, especially as far as health care is concerned.
Very good. One final question for you, Congressman Abraham. When you look at this election that's before us, coming up in about 2 weeks, just a little over 2 weeks, will that make a difference, the way this election goes, to the topic we're talking about, the future of Obamacare?
Trump has said that in the first 100 days he would allow us to repeal Obamacare, which we have done in the House, and he would actually sign it, whereas President Obama has vetoed it. So that was, Obamacare would go away under Trump, and we would replace it with a very good, affordable, workable plan. Now, if Hillary gets the president, she has said that all she is going to do is keep pouring money into the Obamacare debacle, and it's just going to get worse and worse. So I don't think the lines between the two candidates would be more stark than on this one issue, the Obamacare issue.
All right, Congressman Ralph Abraham, thanks so much for joining us on this Monday afternoon. Great to talk with you.
Thank you all. Y'all have a great day.
To find out more about how Obamacare is hurting families, go to TonyPerkins.com. Coming up next, has the Obama administration enforced a religious litmus test for some of their overseas appointments? Pete Hoekstra has the answer. We'll be back with more Washington Watch Weekly right after this.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
Every day, Christian values are being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy at an alarming rate. What can ordinary Christian citizens do to make their voices heard in an arena that is set on silencing them? FRC is here to help. Every week on the FRC blog, we will publish a question of the week that people like you are asking around the country, along with our answer. Send us a question you may have about how you can better live out your faith beyond the four walls of your church, or about any specific value that FRC continues to stand for, whether it be life, marriage and family, or religious liberty. Go to frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line for the chance to be published on our blog. Again, that's frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line. Thank you for standing with us.
How important is a party platform? Some argue that since a platform is just a set of goals established by a political party, it can be easily ignored. As it turns out, platforms matter significantly. Why? In the past 30 years, Republicans in Congress voted for positions supported by their party platform 89% of the time, while Democrats did so at a rate of 74%. This matters. Because if Republicans and Democrats in Congress make good on their party platform's promises, people of faith heading to the polls in November can be confident that Republicans will defend life, marriage, and religious liberty, while Democrats will devalue those principles. It's now more important than ever to know exactly where both parties stand and to spread the word. For a concise two-page platform comparison on the issues that matter most to values voters, visit www.frcaction.org/2016.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm your host, David Salkeld. According to the latest round of previously unseen hacked emails released by WikiLeaks, the Obama White House kept a list of Muslims for top jobs in his administration. The emails were sent to the chair of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign, John Podesta. Joining Tony to talk about the documents is former Michigan Representative Pete Hoekstra.
Pete, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, it's very nice to be with you, Tony. Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, Pete, first, I guess I have to ask you the question. I mean, with your position, former position as the House Intelligence Committee chairman, I mean, this is the kind of stuff you deal with, national security, you dealt with. I mean, just the fact that these emails have been hacked into and going back to Hillary's server and the emails that may have been hacked from there, that's problematic. These things are at risk. This shows that. But in this particular case, with the Obama administration creating a jobs list, a hiring list, based upon the fact that individuals are Muslims, is that not problematic?
It is problematic. But, you know, every administration or assumptive administration, right now there's two transition teams at work in Washington, D.C., partially funded by the federal government. They are developing policy frameworks for if their candidate wins. They're also starting to identify people that may serve in a future administration and what those jobs will be. But I find it very interesting that, you know, again, it appears from the content of these emails that they're expressly excluding Christians from these Muslim-majority countries in the Middle East, which is something that these countries and some of these countries, they don't even do. If you go to Jordan, King Abdullah has very much a mixed cabinet, including Christians and you know, a range of people, because they believe that it's the way to... They're, actually, Jordan's probably much more diverse than what the Obama administration was looking at.
Yeah, an aide wrote in one of these emails that was released, quote, "In the candidates for top jobs, I have excluded those with some Arab-American backgrounds but who are not Muslim." Would that then suggest that they were using a religious test?
It would suggest that. Obviously, you'd have to peel back a few more layers to see exactly what they were doing. But, you know, Tony, what we do know is that this administration coming into office wanted to change their relationship, America's relationship with the Muslim world. And so they engaged with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the group from which all these radical jihadist groups throughout the Middle East, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and groups like that take their inspiration from. It's, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928 and with the express purpose of reestablishing the caliphate. This administration wanted to change the narrative with these folks. They put in, you know, they believe that many of the problems in the Middle East and the problems that with the Muslim world are the result of American foreign policy. If we changed our behavior towards them, they would change their behavior towards us. There was a bias towards, in many cases, radical jihadist groups. We changed our behavior. They changed their behavior, too. They became much more aggressive. They saw an opening, and they took advantage of it.
Right. And we see that from a standpoint of our foreign policy. That's very clear, very evident. I mean, we see the Middle East imploding. But let's talk about what we haven't seen and what these emails give us just a glimpse into. If there was a profiling, a positive profiling of Muslims to put them in some top positions, which we don't have the list of those positions, and you talked about the cozy relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, could we not this administration actually ceded some critical positions in our administration with people who may have a hostile view toward America's democracy?
Well, you and I might view it as a hostile attitude towards America's democracy. We're doing completing a study at the Investigative Project on Terrorism that also shows the extensive welcoming of Muslim Brotherhood groups and other radical jihadists in the United States. And going to back where we started this conversation, we know that, you know, whether it appears in appointments, Christians from the Middle East were blocked from coming here. We also can see from the refugee flows coming into America that very, very few numbers of Christians have been allowed to come into the United States as part of the refugee program, although they are the number one target for ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, that's obvious. I mean, it's like 96% are Muslim. I mean, you get like 1 or 2%.
I think you're being way too generous. I think it's close to 99.6 or something like that. But it's the number of Christians and other religious minorities in the Middle East who have been welcomed into the United States because of their refugee status is minuscule. And the number of people who have died in the Middle East as a result of the ISIS's focused genocide against them. You know, it's been horrendous.
Yeah. And this, again, just pulls back the curtain just a little bit so we can see that what we've long suspected to be the case is, in fact, the case. Pete Hoekstra, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Great to talk with you.
Thank you, and thanks for all your work, Tony.
To find out more about anything you've heard on today's program, go to TonyPerkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.